Vous êtes vacciné? Plus vite, vous pouvez participer. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening and welcome to Amandla here on CQT 90.3 FM, your weekly African news and analysis show. So the Amandla team has decided to take what we would consider a well-deserved break. We're going to take the next few weeks off, but we've taken time to pull out what we consider some of the best of our programming over the last year or so. During these strange times of COVID, we nonetheless managed to pull together some interesting and relevant information. So Doug has kindly gone through our archives and pulled out pieces that we think bear rebroadcasting. So for the next 3 weeks, folks, we will be gone, and the faithful staff at CKUT will be making sure that these shows hit the airwaves every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Montreal time.
So welcome again to Amandla, CKUT 90.3. I have with me on the Zoom, Dua El Mardi. Welcome, Dua. Nice to have
you
back.
Thank you.
Can you hold it a little closer? Yeah.
And yep. Then, is this good?
That's excellent. And then Helden is here with us again.
Yes, hello.
Hope you're doing well in this time of COVID.
I am doing well. And good. I hope
you're doing well too. So, Dua, when we spoke, oh my gosh, I can't even remember the last time, a lot of water has gone under the bridge in Sudan, and the events had rolled so fast over the period of 2019, late 2018 into the summer of 2019 here. And I think the last thing I heard from you was something about the Transitional Council in September. Can you just give us some background and bring us back into the picture and what's going on in Sudan right now?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you're right, Doug. It's been quite a while since we spoke, and there's been so much happening in Sudan at the time, which obviously I think that it takes too long to cover everything that's going on. So I will be just kind of giving brief points just so people can have a general idea of what's going on. And then I hope that people would, be able to read more on what's happening. But basically, as you're aware, and I'm guessing a lot of people are aware, the protest in Sudan, the movement, sort of this pro-democracy movement, started in mid-December in 2018. And basically, people were demanding the overthrow of Omar al-Bashir, who's the head of the National Congress Party, known as the NCP, and they've been there for 30 years. It's a 30-year repressive dictatorship. So people have had enough. They hit the streets demanding for change. And then there's been sort of like protest ongoing. And then in April 2019, there's a body called the Sudanese Professionals Association, which called for a sit-in in front of the Sudan armed forces in Khartoum, the headquarters. So there's millions of Sudanese who had that sit-in. And al-Bashir was ousted on April 11th by a military coup d'etat. And then, but the sit-ins have continued since then. They've had like a 24-hour, which in Sudan we call the shortest leader ever known, Ibn Auf. 24 hours, he resigned because of the pressure in the street. And then people continued to pressure. So there was a 58-day sit-in. This is the sit-in in October, and in April. And then unfortunately, it was dispersed on June 3rd. Which was also the 29th of Ramadan. So this was right before Eid, when families were ready to celebrate.
And it was brutally dispersed.
It was absolutely brutal. It was a massacre. It took lives of more than 100 people. There was at least 40 bodies that were thrown in the Nile that was later to be found. There was hundreds of civilians, unarmed civilians, who were arrested. There was more than 70 rapes that happened. So this is known as the Khartoum Massacre. And it was directed by the Transitional Military Council, So which was Al-Burhan, Al-Kabashi, and others, and also the Rapid Support Forces, which is the successor organization of the Janjaweed paramilitary.
Noted for their brutality in Darfur.
Absolutely, and headed by the warlord, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, his locally known as Hemeti. So these were the bodies that orchestrated this, this massacre. And then since then, Sudan and Sudan is currently it's basically ruled by a power sharing deal that has happened since August of 2019. And this power sharing deal is between the Military Council and the Alliance or the Forces of Freedom and Change, who are basically like the body that's representing the umbrella of the opposition leaderships and basically the civilian side of this agreement. And this is headed by the economist prime minister, Abdullah Hamdok.
So it's a civilian prime minister now.
Yes, it's a civilian prime minister, Abdullah Hamdok. And basically the two sides have agreed to rotate chairmanship of the council, eventually paving the way for an election in Sudan. So that's sort of like the general idea of the deal. But as you can already like tell from a deal like this, this is a very, very fragile power sharing deal, because there is a very clear imbalance of power here, of who has more power and who doesn't have as much power. So the Military Council has control over the security apparatus, they have control over the police, they have control over the military and the Rapid Support Forces, the militia. While basically the civilian side, you know, is more in charge of like the Ministry of education and, you know, so the more civilian Ministry of Health, more civilian stuff, but the real power is still in the hands of the Military Council. And the civilian side, from the beginning of this, has been really tiptoeing between satisfying the public and sort of not upsetting or not, you know, not having any clashes with the Military Council in any way. And this is like, I'd have to admit, like in the beginning of this power sharing deal, a lot of people were very optimistic in Sudan, and a lot of people, and you know, people who were sort of like trying to give an analysis that wasn't so optimistic of the situation were really just deemed as pessimistic, and you know, they were sort of like taken out of the conversation. But now you're that's changing. You know, now people are really starting to realize that this is not going the way it was thought it would work.
So what's happening? Are the people back in the streets?
Yeah, the people have been back in the streets. You know, a couple of weeks after the massacre, on June 30th, last year, millions of people hit the street. They were demanding for justice for the martyrs of the revolution, and so on. And then by the end of last year, sort of like around mid-September, there's been a huge wave of several protests happening over several different reasons across the country. And so I'd just like to briefly talk about what these protests are. So there's been, this is on different issues. There's been, for example, issues of the appointment of Chief of Justice and Attorney General. So that kind of took a while. And so people were getting upset about that. People were protesting about that. There's also a very important movement that was happening in southern Kurdufan and in northern state, which is against the use of cyanide and mercury for gold mining. These areas, an area, for example, Talodi in South Kurdufan, which is an area that's very rich in gold. So there's a lot of gold mining companies in that area, including Hemeti has his own, the Rapid Support Forces, they have their own gold mining companies in the area. So these companies have been using cyanide and mercury, and there's a lot of poisoning in the area. It's, you know, it's completely bad for their health and bad for the environments in the area. So people have, in those areas, have actually been doing sit-ins outside of these companies and sit-ins in their areas, demanding that the government, you know, puts an end to this.
That's amazing. So that people feel empowered to confront this resource extraction stuff.
Yeah.
Been foisted on them over 30 years of the military.
Yep, absolutely. And there's been kind of protests and solidarity of what's happening in Talodi and other parts of Sudan. This eventually had resulted in the government shutting down all the mining companies in the area, but of course, with the exception of the three companies that are owned by Hemeti. So those were not touched. So that kind of made people even more angry. So people marched to those companies where they were met with live ammunition, and they were beaten very forcibly. So to date, I still know that these companies are still functioning, Hemeti's companies in the area, but other companies have been shut down. Other protests that have happened. Oh, did you want to ask
a quick question in regards to that? So, when there are these protests up in the cities you just mentioned, is it the military then that intervenes, or it's private security within the for those private companies that are within that area?
It's private security, and it's also rapid support forces that have their own securities there as well. But the government, all they did was they released public statements condemning the use of tear gas and the brutal use of force on people. Mm-hmm. But they still haven't really done anything tangible to those companies.
And nobody's been punished.
No, which is the case, which is always the case. Like, nobody gets punished when it's done by the someone who's in relation to the government itself. There's been a lot of protest on against state governors, because there were older state governors from the previous regime who remained in place and in a lot of places, and people protested against those state governors, which had led to a lot of the state governors being removed. There were protests calling for trials for leadership of the previous regime. So there's a lot of people are not really on the same page exactly on whether al-Bashir and the people from the previous regime should be having trials locally, or whether they should be extradited to the ICC. There's a lot of disagreements between people and what really should happen. But so far, al-Bashir is the only one who's been having trials. He's been having trials inside the country. But there isn't anything.
So that does, your statement there just brings up the question again of the Forces for Freedom and Change. How well are they able to maintain their coalition, their solidarity, or is it becoming fractious?
I'm afraid it is becoming fractious. There's been a lot of internal disagreements that are happening, which, we're really hopeful that settles down a little bit, and we're able to focus on the bigger picture of what we're doing here. But there has been a lot of fractions internally.
And does the popular uprising we see operate within those fractions, or does it seem to be generalized so that that opposition civilian side has to pay respect to their power base this way?
It does, in a lot of ways, it does work on its own, really, unfortunately. The power, at least now, the power of the street is working on its own, and they are being forced to kind of hear what people want to say. And if people have different opinions and different, different thoughts on how they're doing things.
The big question at this point, of course, is, and we saw it in many, we've seen it in many other situations, where repressive regimes used COVID and the imposition of lockdowns and that kind of thing to bypass constitutional reforms and governance. How has COVID impacted the Sudan and the situation there?
Well, COVID definitely has impacted Sudan, and Sudan right now, unfortunately, is one of the worst in the Horn of Africa and in the entire of Africa in terms of the numbers that we have. We have more than 9,000 cases, or almost 9,000 cases right now. There's over 500 deaths, and more than 80% of the cases are concentrated in Khartoum, but other states also have infections. And unfortunately, those official figures that we have are really believed to be severely underestimated to the real extent of the pandemic in Sudan. The virus really hit Sudan at a very critical time of transitions, and also a very critical time economically in Sudan. The economy right now, Sudan is really in a very deep economic crisis. And people really can't, this was just one more thing that's being added to people's bags. People already are really suffering.
And in terms of governance, it appears that they, as a government, given that it's transition and a mix of military and civilian, didn't respond particularly well to how to manage it.
I would say that the civilian government is really have tried its best given their capacity, because we know that their capacity is very limited to what they can actually do. However, there's been a lot of mistakes that happened, and naturally, because they already have deployed the militia in the streets for the lockdown, and they have deployed some military in the streets for the lockdown, that already definitely means that there is repression. So when you have different troops of militias in the street, in stations, in lockdown stations across the country, obviously you don't have a lot of control over what these troops can do. So there has been repression. There has been repression over people who sort of didn't abide by the lockdown hours. There has been an incident in Khartoum a few months ago where in Abu Hamama neighborhood where the militia has actually shot down two guys who were in a rickshaw, in a tuk-tuk, and they were just like a few minutes past the lockdown time. They shot them down. They died.
Okay.
So obviously, you know, that's kind of a thing that comes naturally when you have deployed troops in the streets for lockdown.
And especially the military with the reputation and background of this one.
Absolutely. So obviously, you know, there has been repression. I wouldn't say there's no repression. There has been repression. There's a lot of people are being fined a lot of money for not sticking by the lockdown time. So like, this has obviously hit people economically hard. The lockdown has really hit people hard. And also at the same time, the healthcare system in Sudan, given what Al-Bashir's regime has been doing, it's a very, very fragile healthcare system. It cannot handle a mass of cases that all come at the same time. The whole country has less than 80 ventilators that are functioning in the whole country.
How many?
80, less than 80.
For 44 million people.
Yeah, and that's mostly in the capital city. Outside of the capital city, there's very, very few of them. There's a scarcity in ICU beds. Doctors don't have, and nurses don't have protection equipments. A lot of the hospitals had to be understaffed because a lot of the doctors and the nurses had to self-isolate because, you know, they contacted patients. And so that means a lot of hospitals were understaffed. A lot of hospitals closed. And this was also because there was kind of a mismanagement, I guess, from the beginning of the crisis from the government a little bit in terms of the practices in hospitals. So there's been bad decisions that were made that caused some hospitals to be shut down, and that obviously translates into the general healthcare of the country. So if for example, maternity was a big issue where the maternity rates have increased, the death in maternity has increased because people didn't really have another, you know, a lot of hospitals where they can go and give birth safely.
Or they were afraid to go to the hospital because they would just be in danger.
Yeah, and then people with other health issues that are non-COVID, a lot of them couldn't go to the hospital now because a lot of hospitals weren't taking non-COVID cases anymore. So there's been a lot of confusion, and there's been cases where doctors were beaten by co-patients, doctors were beaten by the public. And the government wasn't doing anything. There's been cases where doctors and journalists, the journalist union, the journalist association, for example, talks a lot these days about the repression of journalists during this lockdown. The journalists in Sudan are not able to perform their functions well because they cannot pass a lockdown. They keep getting harassed by the militia and by the troops there. And it's the same with doctors, for example. A lot of doctors had to go to work, had to be in hospital, and they couldn't get past the lockdown, and they would get into issues with the militias. So this has severely affected very various aspects of life in Sudan.
Well, Duha, I think one thing we can agree on is that Sudan is going through a lot of African countries are going through, but are very specific in its own right. But I want to just bring this conversation back to something that we mentioned before the show started about a visit that happened. Some officials that, maybe you can give us a backstory and then we can jump into the story itself. I don't want us to run out of time before we touch on that because I'm very highly interested to learn from you. So can you just give us a backstory of what exactly the visit was, and then why are we talking about it here at Amanda?
Yeah, sure. So this actually happened in February, and it was actually a secret meeting that for some leaked stuff we got to know that it happened. And this happened in Entebbe in Uganda, this was between Burhan, who's the head of the Sovereign Council, and Benjamin Netanyahu. And this was facilitated by someone who's a diplomat called Najwa Gada Haddam. She just recently passed away due to COVID-19. And I don't know if you have probably seen, there was a plane that flew in from Israel to Sudan, and it was detected. And it was found that this plane was actually coming to save her life with doctors from Israel and medical equipment and so on, but they couldn't save her life. So Najwa was the person who was basically behind this organizing of this meeting that happened. But the government itself, the government of Sudan and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, actually denied any knowledge of this meeting. When this came to the public, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs said that they had no knowledge, no prior knowledge of this, that they just found out about this meeting just like the public did, which goes to tell a lot, again, of the relationship that's happening. If the Ministry of Affairs says, we didn't know about this high-profile meeting, we had no idea, we weren't invited, nobody told us about it, but it happened. And this meeting, it was said that this meeting was basically over normalizing relationships between Israel and Sudan, which is something we haven't had in decades. Like, it's never there. So
what is the backstory? What is the relations between, or diplomatic or otherwise, between Sudan and Israel?
There is no diplomatic relationships between Israel and Sudan. There hasn't been any diplomatic relationships. So that's why this came as such a big move that the government didn't know about. The really important thing is that there was a lot of resistance from people in Sudan. So when people found out that this had happened, people hit the streets and protested against this for several different reasons. Obviously, there's also the big factor, which is the way that the relationship and the sort of like the view that people have on Israel all these years from the government doesn't necessarily, I would say, come from an anti-colonial perspective, but more of a sort of a religious anger that the government of al-Bashir has made people to think about. So there's that aspect of this being something that is just not acceptable to people religiously. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the left in Sudan also join those protests, but because, you know, from the aspect of the completely anti-colonial, anti-imperialist notion.
Now this, was it a military setup or was it the government jointly military and civilian?
No, it was only a military setup, and it was actually only Burhan himself who attended this meeting. I'm not sure if anybody else attended.
Because this represents Burhan. An enormous shift with the relations with Sudan and, Saudi Arabia and participation in the Yemen debacle. Wow.
Yeah.
What do you see that going? Where do you see that going? What are they trying to do?
I don't know. I think there definitely was talks. I mean, the talks happened for sort of a beginning of a normalizing of a relationship. But since then, as I told you, the person who was orchestrating and behind the scenes of this had just passed away recently over the COVID virus. And since then, we haven't heard anything again. From if there's a follow-up, we don't know. There hasn't been anything.
On a little back further in history than even all of this, just about a week or two ago, we got news that Ali Kushaib, who had been a major militia leader in the Darfur region, has been hiding out in Central African Republic for about 13 years on the run, and was finally nabbed and handed over to the International Criminal Court.
Yep.
Where's Sudan at in that reckoning of injustice?
So as I said, generally there is locally, there's been a disagreement over what's going to happen with the previous regime, people who are wanted by the ICC. So the Omar al-Bashir, the president, the ex-president himself is wanted by the ICC. Abdulrahim Mohamed Hussein, who was the minister of interior at the time and later became the minister of defense, he's wanted by the ICC. Ahmed Haroun is wanted by the ICC. There's someone else, and there's Ali Kushaib who was recently brought in, and his trial happened on June 15th. So Ali Kushaib himself, he's charged with 50 crimes against humanity and war crimes altogether. So it's not going to be good for him at all.
Oh boy!
From this point, sounds like he's already been on the run for like 13 years. And now his trial happened. But there has been, so if you've been following, there's been the peace negotiations that have been happening in Juba. That's between the government and different rebel groups, different armed rebel groups in different parts of the country. And this has been ongoing for a few months now, and it's still ongoing. But from there, we have heard that that the member of the Sovereign Council, Abdullah Ta'ashi, he had mentioned that the council agreed with rebel groups in Darfur to hand over those wanted by the ICC to face justice.
This is interesting. So in Juba, South Sudan, already a separated independent country, is hosting Sudanese leadership across.
This is tremendous.
On that same score, how is the movement maintaining that multi-ethnic solidarity that we saw at the beginning?
I think it's still there. And the one thing that tells us that is, as I said, there's been different things that are happening across the country. And whenever those things happen, there's solidarity protests that happen across the country. For example, I wanted to talk about things that have been happening in Darfur. There's, for example, the University of Zalinji had a student that drowned recently, and this kind of brought protest against this the student welfare body, which is, it's, you know, in universities across Sudan, and it's one of the bodies that was really infiltrated by the previous regime. So there's been a lot of solidarity protests on that. There's been a lot of things happening in Mershing and Niala in terms of violence, and there's solidarity protests happening across the country for that. There was brutal use of force and against students that were protesting in Niala. This was around September last year. The police heavily used tear gas and beat people there. There were students protesting for shortages of bread and dismissing the dismissal of the state governor. So this had a lot of solidarity movements outside. There was a week-long sit-in in Al Jazeera. This is very small area in Al Jazeera called Al Hilaliya. These people have been doing sit-ins for 1 week. And this was, they wanted basically to dismiss the security committee in their area. They wanted to dismiss the state governor, the head of the area. So there's been also solidarity protest in that. And then there was the very big, in the anniversary of the October 1964 revolution, so October 21st last year, there was a very, very big general protest that happened across the country. And this was sort of like to correct the path of the revolution, which obviously already, you know, the thing itself, the name itself says that there has been a deviation from the path of the revolution.
We've only got about 5 minutes left on the time of Zoom that we have available to us. So first, Helden, do you have any other issues to bring up?
No, thank you very much. That was a good resume, at least with the specific points to look out for.
Okay. Thank you. And anything else, Dua, that we've overlooked, missed, that you want to point out to?
Yeah, I do want to say that there's been a lot of push for an investigation on the June 3rd massacre, which has ended up with an official investigation on the June 3rd massacre that's led by a human rights lawyer, Nabil Adib. We have yet to hear anything from this committee, although they have interviewed over 3,000 survivors and witnesses and so on. We haven't heard anything, and there's been, basically people are waiting for this. There hasn't been anything that come out from this.
Give us a last summary statement about where you think things are at this point.
I honestly just think that the government, that the civilian side of the government has really, as I said, they've been very careful in terms of their relationships with the military side. There's a severe imbalance of power between these two sides of the situation. And the government of Sudan is really kind of trying to, they're basically mainly focusing on the economic side, because the country, as I said, is really in a deep economic crisis right now. So they are trying to focus on that mainly. But the main demands of the revolution have not been met. And people are aware of that. And the streets are talking. People are out in the streets. There's a protest that's planned now for June 30th. And a lot of people will be out in the streets. So people are watching them and people know what they're doing.
And
well, thank you very much, Duha. I'd like actually to maybe just pass it on between you. Maybe it would be interesting to do another segment, but talk about the access to information or to news that we have nowadays and all this talk about fake news. I'm wondering how it affects some of our countries in Africa where some journalists might not have the freedom to say what it is that they're seeing on ground. Others might not. Anyways, that is a whole conversation on its own. So thank you again.
Clearly we've got a lot more to talk about. Thank you, yes. Dua, so much for this. It's wonderful. Nice to see you again.
Thank you so much. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for doing this. Take
care. Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
Bye. Just a brief reminder that this is a rebroadcast from previous issues of Amandla. Stay tuned. We're going to start in the 50s because Uli... Uli, thank you very much for coming in. And
always good to be here.
The reason I'm so happy that we're together, Uli and I, here in Montreal, because when Uli was a much younger man like myself and he had a figure and hair and all the rest of it, he actually went and met Dumiso Dabengwa and interviewed him for quite a sizable booklet that was part of the Liberation Support Movement's project to present the struggle of Southern Africa, and the hero of that, the focus of that, was Dumiso Dabengwa, although at the time, to call him a hero, he would have been so humiliated, that wouldn't have been what he wanted. So tell me, how did you first meet Uli? How did you first meet Dumiso?
Well, it was my first time in Africa. I was working with the Liberation Support Movement, and we did many things to support the struggle against apartheid and also the liberation movements in the Portuguese colonies, Angola, Mozambique,
and of course,
and in Zimbabwe. And we had a publishing house. And one project that we had, a series of books, we did life histories of revolutionaries who might not be very well known, but inside the different liberation movements. So I was assigned, we went to Southern Africa. It was my first trip. We asked ZAPU, the Zimbabwe African People's Union, whose story could we tell in a book form that would tell the world what their struggle was all about. So this was delicate because we're in the middle of a war. They are in a difficult situation.
Oh,
1972, they are under attack. They're from South Africa, from everywhere. And now here comes somebody from Canada who wants to write a book about something that's going on in the middle of them. So they conferred, and they decided that I should come to a safe house in Zambia. I should lay low there, not be visible at all, and I should spend a week with a man called Dumiso Dabengwa. I didn't know who he was.
Even then he was a big man.
Yes. Now, here is the score. They wanted the story, but they had to protect his identity.
Absolutely.
So we spent a week. I had a little tape recorder that anthropologists use, a Ewer tape recorder, and ultimately we wrote this book.
The Organizer.
The Organizer, the story of Temba Moyo, which is the name they chose for Dumiso Dabengwa, not wanting to reveal his identity. And back in Canada, it was lovingly transcribed, laid out by hand, typed on an IBM Selectric in a little garage in East Vancouver. And we made thousands of these. ZAPU used them. It was republished in other languages. We did the same in South Africa, in Namibia, in Angola, in Guinea-Bissau. And, you know, these books went everywhere. And if you want to know the inside story of a big chapter of the Zimbabwean War for Liberation. You should go to
this book.
Work like this. I'm actually now, you know, what is it, almost 50 years later, I'm very proud of this book and other books that we did. And ZAPU really used the book. They loved it. Now it's on the internet. You can find it. The Excellent. Organizer.
Excellent. And I'm so happy I have my original copy as well. So let's go back. Give
yes.
us some context.
Let's
you
go back.
You got to know this guy, and he told you his story from the beginning.
Yeah. And, you know, Rhodesia. So people will know the name. What now has faded into the background was Rhodesia, which is next to South Africa, a British colony, into the 1960s. It's like another apartheid world, slightly different, much more rural than South Africa. Dumiso grew up in the years after the Second World War. And at that time, the African land in Zimbabwe was being given away to British soldiers who had fought in the Second World War.
They were
being brought to settle in Rhodesia at the time, and the Africans were being pushed out.
At the same time, African soldiers who had served in the Second World War...
They got a bicycle. And a British lieutenant or corporal got 200 acres of African land. So in a few years of Dumis, he tells this story in the book. He went to this ceremony where Africans were given bicycles. And he said, why are they giving bicycles? Well, because they fought in the war. But the British people who came here and took our land, they got our land because they fought in the war. And that was, Dumisa must have been 6-7 years old at the time. His parents were teachers. And they were very aware, highly educated. But people in that position, Africans in that position, are right up in the face of the white,
Absolutely.
Of the discrimination. In Rhodesia, at the height of colonialism there, you had 300,000 whites and 4.5 million Africans. And they felt the racism and the discrimination
at every turn.
And his parents, teachers, and father became a school principal, humiliated on a daily basis. And Dumiso excelled in school. His parents
Absolutely.
Demanded great things of him. When he went to look for work in Bulawayo, he was offered work, and he tried. He would get £15 a month.
He got a job at the Barclays Bank.
His bosses were white. They had less education than him. They were making 3 times more money
yes.
than him. So he got involved at an early age as the Zimbabwe nationalist movement grew up. He became an organizer in the youth front. And by the end of the 1950s, he's in jail, a political prisoner,
Already?
One of the very
wow.
early ones.
Now, he was also part of that whole transition through the various whatever. It was almost like the ANC Zimbabwe subsidiary. And then, anyway, he went through
yeah.
that.
In the beginning, they were very... It was the ANC, African National Congress of Rhodesia, that was banned. People thrown in jail. Then it became another organization. Actually, the National Democratic Party. They were banned. More people in jail. Then they formed ZAPU. At that time, they knew already that they were going to be banned. Some of the leaders, the head of ZAPU, Joshua Nkomo, had left the country. And at the crucial time in 1962, Dumiso and a few others are told, move on, get out of here. They made their way to Zambia, which was becoming an independent country at that time, by way of Tanzania, which had just become an independent country at that time. And they know that the Rhodesians are there to stay. They are going nowhere, and they're going to have to fight for their liberation. And in not very long time, Dumiso is in the Soviet Union together with another group. He's being trained as an intelligence officer.
So this is the early 60s now.
This is the early 60s. There are Africans being sent to Algeria, to Egypt, to China,
Cuba.
To Cuba. Cuba comes a little later.
Okay.
To be trained as soldiers. Dumiso is a soldier, but he is also trained by KGB to collect intelligence, also because he has been a very effective organizer. He's very smart. He's huge. He's very good-looking. He can charm the pants off you. But he's an extremely efficient organizer.
And you'd never know who he was.
You'd never know who he was because he stays in the background. They come back, 65, 66. They begin to return to Africa, and the war begins. And here, I am sitting here, you know, the hair was standing up on my head. I'm listening to these stories of the early parts of the liberation war in Zimbabwe. And it's brutal. It's almost under the radar. They are under incredible pressure. They don't have much. They have to find all the dynamite to blow up railroad tracks and industry. They have to acquire it locally. You know, it's a new organization. They are amateurish in many ways. The people like Dumiso who are coming in from Zambia, they have to cross the Zambezi River.
Ooh, and
crocodiles or angry hippos and elephants. And at some point, he tells me, he's in the middle of, with his comrades, of a firefight with a Rhodesian army patrol. He's running through the bush, and all of a sudden, he's in the middle of a prey of lions. He's surrounded by by lions. Well, he doesn't want to shoot them and reveal his whereabouts to the Rhodesians. But anyway, this war goes on for a number of years, and it takes a big toll on them. They get... They make a lot of headway. They lose a lot of people. Many people are caught, tortured.
I think we should also mention that this is part of what was historically known as the Wanky Campaign, which was a joint campaign with ANC and ZAPU.
That comes in 1967.
That's 67.
That's a big campaign, which ultimately the objective is for them to go far enough into Zimbabwe, win enough land so that the ANC, the 80 ANC fighters who are fighting with ZAPU, can make their way into South Africa. They do not succeed.
Of course.
Because by this time, South Africa has joined the war. South Africa is basically saying, we'd rather fight the terrorists on the Zambezi than fighting them on the Limpopo. So they are there with their air force, with their special units, and fully engaged in the war. So it's tough. It's difficult. We should also say that by this time, there has been a split in the nationalist movement that comes to have great consequences later on. The ZAPU leadership came up against a group who were ethnically different from them. There are two main population groups, ethnic groups in Zimbabwe. The Ndebele, where's from the south and southwest, where Dumiso is from, are in a minority, and the majority are from the north and the east of Zimbabwe, the Shona. And this split has major consequences as we go later.
Absolutely.
And especially after independence.
But by 72, it has the consequence of creating two liberation movements.
Yes, because Now we are in the 1970s, and South Africa, Southern Africa, is in flames because you have wars in Angola and in Mozambique, where the MPLA and Frelimo are pushing back the Portuguese. You have the war in Zimbabwe, and you have an armed struggle in Namibia. South Africa is fully engaged in all of these wars, and in Rhodesia, it is not going very well. ZANU is able to take advantage of the war in Mozambique because Frelimo in Mozambique is making great progress and is controlling large areas of Mozambique, and it gives ZANU access to the whole eastern region of Zimbabwe. And it's much easier to fight the Rhodesians in the east, in the mountains and the forest, than it is in the densely populated and industrialized west and southwest.
And the exposed savannas and semi-desert areas of the west.
Yeah. So the war in Zimbabwe, the military equilibrium is shifting to the east. But as you will remember, Doug, as we get into the middle of the 70s and later, basically the war in Rhodesia is becoming too costly for South Africa to support. There were sanctions. Remember, we here in Montreal, we had towards the end, 1979, when negotiations began for a settlement in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, we even sent delegates from Montreal. Bonnie Campbell from UQAM was sent here. We mobilized, and we sent people to observe at what became the peace conference. Flora MacDonald, who was foreign minister of Canada, went in the Joe Clark government, and they played a big role when the chips came down to find a recipe to end the war and make Rhodesia into Zimbabwe.
Okay, now let's get back to Dumiso. Where's Dumiso in all this?
So Dumiso is basically, if you don't know ZAPU from the inside, you won't know who Dumiso is. His job is to stay deep. But what he is successfully doing behind the scenes, sometimes he is outside the country, but he spends a lot of time inside. He strikes up a very good relationship with his counterpart in ZANU, Josiah Tongongara. And this is intended so to prevent that there is going to be any violence, any armed friction
between the two factions
when they return back to Zimbabwe, when the war is over and Zimbabwe will become independent. That was not to be, because Tongongara was killed in a traffic accident in Mozambique, strangely and mysteriously, and we can only speculate what was behind that. I arrived in Mozambique just after this, and we never really talked about it. You weren't supposed to even talk about it. Anyway, the fact is that relationship ceased to exist, and that became very important, very, very tragic, actually.
Because the tensions in the assembly points were enormous. The assembly points brought together the ZAPU, the ZIPRA militants, the ZANU militants, and the Rhodesian Army.
Yes, because there was a big rear guard. Many Rhodesians were leaving, but many stayed, hanging on, including the army and the intelligence. And as we have seen later on, and the same thing happened in Mozambique when I was working there, there was a white settler rear guard whose de facto work was to sabotage independence and sabotage. And they actually manipulated the tension that was already there, but to provoke.
But there was the Bengwa.
There was the Bengwa.
He was always there pushing for the unity, pushing for the harmony, trying to placate.
And maybe that's why he was set up. Because at some point, ZANU, the majority party, controlled the government. Robert Mugabe had become the prime minister. He was not yet president. He had become the prime minister, but the effective leader of the country. He did not want an effective opposition. He was out to have ZANU completely
controlled. He wanted
controlled.
To crush ZANU.
That's right. So Dumiso and some other ZAPU leaders are set up, and they are charged with treason for having cashed large amounts of weapons to try to take power, basically.
And literally
in a coup.
After Independence Day, like 81 or 82 years.
Within 2 years after independence, in 1982. And he's brought to trial. The judge says this is all hokum. The man is innocent. You can see all he does is working for peace and harmony here. So he was let go, but outside the door of the courtroom, the special branch is waiting, and he is rearrested, thrown into prison, and he's in prison for 4 years without any due process.
He was trying to do was help resettle the combatants, try to prevent friction. He really was the peacemaker at this point.
Well, when we see what happened, maybe that's why he was pushed out of the way, because this is the beginning of what actually became a campaign of almost ethnic cleansing. It's known as the Gukurahundi. The Gukurahundi, it's a Shona word. It means the early rain that washes away the chaff, the garbage, from the year before.
Sweeping away the
sweeping away what we
waste.
Don't want and what we don't need. And it was a military campaign that maybe over a period of a year and a half or 2 years, we don't know, we will never know, but maybe 20,000 people is a conservative estimate.
Conservative.
People, normal villagers, were rounded up, shot in lineups. It was horrible. And it has, Dumiso was in prison. It's been a stain on Zimbabwe's independence and relations in Zimbabwe ever since. And the people who were responsible were Robert Mugabe. It is also the crocodile, the man who last year took over from Robert Mugabe. He's called the crocodile. It's Emmerson Mnangagwa, who became one of the most... He was head of security. He became one of the most corrupt and powerful men in Zimbabwe. In fact, he was, I think, the very first man to get a white expropriated farm.
And he directed the 5th Brigade.
He directed the 5th Brigade through a man, a military commander, who called himself the Black Jesus. He called himself the Black Jesus because he said, I decide who will live and who will die. Now he is a cabinet minister in Zimbabwe. It was horrible. It was really horrible. When Dumiso came out of prison, his close comrade, military commander, Lookout Masuku, had died in prison. Dumiso got out with... And he got out to be pushed into a political settlement with the ZANU government in what was called the Patriotic Front. And he was made by the leader of ZAPU, Joshua Nkomo, to take the post of Home Affairs Minister.
And that just what a untenable position for such a man of principle. I mean, this is ridiculous.
Well, it was the political reality, and there he was without very much power. He kept that position. He stayed in that position. He was forced to stay in that position because of the discipline within his organization. But he was frustrated. He had very little power. I think it must have been very, very hard on him to see all the abuse of power, the grotesque kind of corruption that was developing in Zimbabwe.
And the racist ethnicity.
Yeah, yeah.
That wasn't the way.
That wasn't the way. That was not what they had fought for. And he was there until 2002.
So thereafter, he did try once to reinvigorate or to recreate ZAPU. It came alive as a party, I think, around 2008 or something. He tried to run. It wasn't going much anywhere because the forces just didn't have space.
They were on the back foot. ZAPU by that time were on the back foot. I would think, I had no contact during that period. I would think it would surprise me if he was not demoralized and tired. What he did was he supported candidates in the parliamentary opposition to the Mugabe government. He stayed in the background. He did quite a lot of welfare work. They started a foundation. He did community-based work in and tried to build up things in his area of Zimbabwe, but very much stayed in the background.
In 1 minute.
Yes.
Why is Domiso Dabengwa an important figure in African history?
Because I think, first of all, it's the role he played in the liberation struggle. Second, it is because though he is very little known, he did everything he could, and in the end, despite the miserable outcome in Zimbabwe, things could have been a heck of a lot worse without him. Now, I think about him when this happened. So here I am in Lusaka. I'm hearing, he's telling me about this war. In the evening, we go out. This is my first time in Africa. You know, it's a big, strapping guy. We go out for a walk in the township. He takes my hand. Now we're walking down a dusty street in a crowded township, holding hands. I get, what will people think? You know, this is embarrassing. So, man, you're in Africa, you know. This is how we live here. When it was time to have dinner, he taught me how to make zaza, which is the stiff, mealy maize porridge, you know, which is the staple there. So he was such a modest, gentle person, and at the same time, he's a fighter.
He was leading the struggle.
And he's putting his life on the line. And soon after I left to come back to Canada, end of 1972, he's back inside Zimbabwe. And he is wounded several times. He survived. I think they want to make him a hero. I saw the president, the crocodile, on YouTube saying he's a hero, maybe he should be buried in Hero's Acre. Domiso said, not very long ago, he said he wants to be buried at Ntabazinduna. Ntabazinduna is a mountain close to where he grew up, north of Bulawayo. It is known as the mountain where the Ndebele chief Msilikasi executed the people he suspected of plotting against him. That is where he wants to be buried. No Hero's Acre for Domiso Dabengwa.
A luta continua.
Thanks for joining us again on Amandla this week. We will be back next week, and please stay tuned now for Jazz Euphorium.
With the It Pays to Be Vaccinated contest, your COVID-19 vaccination could pay off big time. Every Friday in August, you could win $150,000 and two scholarships of $10,000. Plus, if you've had both shots September 3rd, there's a draw for 16 scholarships of $20,000 and a jackpot of $1 million. Register now for the It Pays to Be Vaccinated contest at quebec.ca/vaccination contest. The sooner you're vaccinated, the faster you can take part. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Salut, ici Matt Track, vous écoutez CKUT 90,3 FM.
What? My radio stuck on CKUT. I don't know. But nah, fix it. CKUT, the number one radio station in Montreal. We give you the sun, the moon, the rain, the stars and the mountain. CKUT give you the world.
La vaccination contre la COVID-19 se poursuit partout au Québec. L'effet combiné des deux doses assure une meilleure efficacité du vaccin, en plus de réduire le risque d'avoir et de transmettre le virus. Vous serez aussi protégé sur une plus longue période. Il est primordial de vous présenter à votre rendez-vous pour la deuxième dose du vaccin, peu importe ce qu'il y a d'autre à votre horaire. La deuxième dose du vaccin est essentielle. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.